Hello and welcome to the Irish History Show on Near FM. My name's Cathal Brennan, and if you'd like to listen to this or previous episodes of the show, you can go to our website, irishhistoryshow.ie. You can also go to our Facebook page or check us out on Twitter at Irish History Pod. Now, today, myself and John Dorney are going to be discussing the 12th of July and also the Orange Order and all the associated things to do with Irish loyalism. So, John, to start off with, what is the 12th of July? What are people commemorating?
Well, the 12th of July is slightly strange in that it's changed its meaning over time. Now, not just in terms of interpretation, but the thing it's actually commemorating has changed. So the original thing it commemorated was the Battle of Aughrim, which was fought on July the 12th, 1691, the culminating battle of the Jacobite-Williamite War. And as the years have gone by, or as the centuries have gone by, that commemoration has moved to the Battle of the Boyne, which was actually fought on July the 1st, 1690, so the previous year. And one explanation for this is that it's due to the change of calendar from the Julian to the Gregorian calendar. Mm. But actually, even if you use that, the Boyne would still be on the 11th, also, our new style rather. So what it actually is the Battle of the Boyne, King William himself, you know, King Billy, King William of Orange was present at. He defeated the Catholic King, King James. So even though it didn't actually end the war, where the Battle of Aughrim was this annihilating defeat, where the Catholic Jacobites were defeated, the Battle of the Boyne has superior symbolism. So it was adopted as the day of Orangeism. And today, I think, apart from perhaps in the song The Sash, the Orange Order barely mentions the Battle of Aughrim. So today, it's the commemoration of the Battle of the Boyne. In terms of what it's commemorating, that too has changed, obviously. But there's a couple of ideas which are constant. One is that the Protestants of Ireland were in danger. They were in danger from a Catholic assault, a repeat of 1641, when they believed the community had come under the risk of extermination. So they believed that was happening again in 1690, that they were delivered both by God, you know, by faith in God, and by King William. So they were delivered from the menace of the Catholic majority. And the other thing which is constant is this idea where King James, the Catholic king, the tyrant, threatened religious and civil liberties. So whereas the Williamites, whereas the Whig tradition, the Orange tradition, is believed to stand for freedom of religion, the rule of law, things like this. On the other side, they imagine, you know, a Catholic monolith, which is on the side of tyranny, you know, and
autocracy
and absolutism.
Yeah.
So those are you can debate those ideas, but those are probably constants in the ideas of when the Boyne is commemorated.
Well, it's a very well used phrase, isn't it? Civil and religious liberties.
Yeah, and it's a funny one, and the reason I say that is because if you look at the actual history of King James, what King James did was the direct opposite of that. So King James was a Catholic, which is a minority religion in England, although the majority in Ireland, of course. And James had to find a way to basically legalise Catholicism. And the way that he did it was to legalise all Christian religions. So he basically enacted freedom of worship, certainly for all Christians, but that included the Scottish nonconformists, the dissenters, if you like, Presbyterians in Scotland, and also the different Calvinist churches in Scotland who had been oppressed, including by James himself. Mm. But, you know, Church solely by the fact that James actually abolished religious discrimination briefly,
yeah,
and he allowed civil and, you know, he allowed actual religious toleration, including for Catholics. I find that argument difficult to sustain. I mean, I suppose the argument is that Catholicism is, by its nature, you know, autocratic, and it's, you know, it's injurious of religious liberty. But
well, we see then with the end of, you know, the Williamite Wars and the Treaty of Limerick, we have what's known as the Protestant Ascendancy.
Yeah.
And how is Ireland shaped in that, like, century afterwards?
Yeah, I mean, the Protestant Ascendancy is actually a term that only begins to be used in the 1790s, I believe. So it's, you know, it's a retrospective thing. It's a term that begins to be used, I think, when that's challenged, you know. So people who call themselves ultra-Protestants, including Orangemen, in the 1790s, started to talk about the Protestant Ascendancy. But to answer your question, so the Williamite Jacobite War is on one face of it is a war between two rivals for the thrones of England and Ireland and Scotland. You know, King James the Catholic, King William the Protestant. But in Ireland, obviously, there's a lot of extra baggage, you know, because most of the pre-17th century population or their descendants, including Gaelic Irish, also Old English, the old townsmen of places like Dublin and Limerick and Cork and so on, were Catholics. Most of the incomers who came in that century from England and from Scotland were Protestants. Almost all of them were. There were some prominent exceptions, but basically all of them were. And it was a very stark communal division in 17th century Ireland, accentuated by the fact that in mid-century, as a result of the Cromwellian conquest, Oliver Cromwell confiscated almost all Catholic land. So the Jacobite War, this very briefly is reversed. So the Jacobites have a parliament where Catholics are the majority. And that's the first, I think, the only time really in British ruled Ireland where that happened. And they reverse all these things. They reverse the Cromwellian land settlement. They reverse, you know, the things which are barring Catholics from access to public jobs, from bearing arms, which is, you know, prominent today in some parts of the world, and from joining the army. And because they'd lose the war, those things are again reversed. So William signs a fairly conciliatory treaty, or not William, actually, his general, Ginkle, with Patrick Sarsfield, who by that time is the Jacobite, the Catholic commander. And under its terms, there will be no extra penal laws against Catholics, and there will be no more confiscation of land. And these are the terms of surrender at Limerick in 1691, mm-hmm. after the Battle of Aughrim. And the problem is that they have to be ratified by the Irish Parliament.
Parliament had something to tell you about that.
It certainly did, because it's all Protestant. So, you know, they figure, you know, if you let these go ahead, we'll have to do the same thing again. We'll have another war in a couple of decades. So the penal laws that follow, they're famous in Irish history, but the penal laws they're aimed at the Catholic Church for sure, but they're also principally aimed at like decapitating the Catholic society as it existed. So, you know, it's a landed society. It's an agrarian society. You cut off the head by confiscating their land, by not allowing them bear arms, by taking away their, you know, their inheritance. There's rules that Catholic land has to be divided up and so on. So the result of the Williamite War is what we know as the Protestant ascendancy, where almost all the land is owned by Protestants. Like, some families actually convert, to be fair, to get around this. Or branches of them sometimes convert. But Catholics are excluded from political power. They're excluded from the army. They're excluded from positions of state. So in the 18th century, Ireland is a Protestant kingdom, albeit the majority of subjects are Catholics.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone involved in politics is Protestant. Almost all the landholding class is Protestant. And that's really the result of the Williamite War. Not quite at the Battle of the Boyne, but certainly of the war.
Protestant Ireland wasn't a monolith either. It was divided among different denominations, and these had their own intercommunal problems.
Yeah, that's a very good point. So when people used the term Protestant in the 18th century, they meant Anglican. They meant the established church, the Church of Ireland. So, especially in the north of Ireland, like, one of the interesting things actually is, nowadays the shorthand is you have the Ulster Plantation back in, you know, the early 1600s, and that brings the Protestants to the north of Ireland. But actually, it's much more complicated. The majority of probably Ulster Protestants today are descended from immigrants in the 1690s, after the Williamite Wars, who fled Scotland really due to famine and poverty, and there was land available in Ulster. And it is at that time that Ulster became predominantly Protestant and very largely Scottish Protestant or Presbyterian. But under the penal laws, they're not quite as harsh on dissenters as they are on Catholics, but they're still pretty harsh. I mean, they have the Jurors Law, I think it's called, where basically you have to hold a public position, you have to swear that the king is the head of the church as well as of the state. And obviously a dissenter can't do this because they don't believe that. So, and things like Presbyterian marriages aren't recognised, for example. So it's quite hard on Presbyterians as well. And also you have a lot of other sects in Ireland, like the Quakers, for example, established quite an influential presence, and there's other groups. And then in the late 18th century, you start to see Methodists appearing. So it's not a monolith at all. Just one quick thing, though. I mean, we're talking about the result of the Boyne and everything like that. Regarding commemorations, so Protestants, and Williamites rather, I should say, do commemorate the 12th of July. They commemorate the Battle of Aughrim with bonfires, really. But the number one commemoration in the 18th century is actually the 23rd of October, which is totally forgotten now, but this is the anniversary of the uprising of 1641. And the import of that is that, you know, they believed the Catholics had risen up and tried to massacre the Protestant community as a whole, and that, you know, the Protestant community had been delivered from this. You know, it was their hour of need, and the Lord had answered them. And there was long sermons in churches that would point this out every year. So it's only at the end of the 18th century that the Boyne starts to get adopted. It's a symbol.
Well, if we move into that period now, the late 18th century, and particularly in Ulster, the northern province in Ireland with the largest Protestant population. This is a period when we see the actual Orange Order founded. But what is the political and communal issues during that period?
Yeah, it's a very tumultuous decade, obviously, the 1790s. I mean, it's a decade of revolution in Europe and further afield in America. And in Ireland, it's the decade where the United Irishmen, which is obviously very strong in Ulster, it's the Republican Society. It's founded in Belfast by Presbyterians, aimed at founding an Irish or eventually aimed at founding an Irish Republic based on, you know, secular principles. It's a decade also where there's a party within the Irish Parliament associated with Henry Grattan, which is basically trying to reform, you know, the state. And I mean, they give Catholics the vote in the 1790s. They allow the Catholic Church to open a training college in Maynooth. Those two things are going parallel. I mean, there's great change in the air. It's also a time of great violence. So, oddly enough, the Orange Order's direct roots are in kind of faction fighting in the Armagh area. And there was a Catholic secret society called the Defenders, and then the Orange Order are believed to have grown out of a secret society called the Pifa Day Boys, and they were fighting violently, and particularly a thing called the Battle of the Diamond, which was a faction fight, a riot if you like, but a very deadly riot in Lochall in Armagh, County Armagh, which the Protestant faction won. But what's interesting about that is it was actually the origins of it were disputes between Catholics and Protestants over Catholics trying to enter the linen trade, the nascent linen trade there. So it's really an economic thing, you know, whereas Protestants and Catholics are fighting for economic supremacy in a kind of a proto-industrial area, which is interesting. So, but the Orange Order really gets mobilised later in the decade because the government, the British government, and also the Irish government as it existed, were very concerned about revolution in Ireland, which was a real possibility. And the Orange Order was viewed as a kind of a plebeian society at the time. It wasn't viewed as, you know, ultra-Protestants, as they called themselves, of the ascendancy class, didn't particularly like the Orange Order, but they mobilised it because it was, you know, it was reliably loyalist. It was, they could be used in things like the yeomanry and so on, against the United Irishmen and against the Defenders and so on, which increasingly became the same kind of thing. And one thing I will say as well is certainly today, we're obviously going to associate the Orange Order with Ulster, and it is founded in Ulster. But the Orange Order is very strong in places like County Wicklow, County Carlow, County, you know, northern part of County Wexford, which at the time are much more Protestant than they would be today, you know, and there's a very strong Orange mobilisation there, kind of counter-revolutionary society. A lot of them are in the yeomanry and so on. Some yeoman captains actually set up Orange lodges in South Leinster at the time. Mm-hmm. So the Orange Order is founded in a period of kind of great conflict, and it's basically, is it a working class society that gets kind of used in a counter-revolutionary way, I would say.
Mm-hmm. It is interesting, and as you say, with these issues like faction fights, when we talk about the Battle of the Diamond, we're not just talking about a skirmish where, you know, there's a couple of cuts and bruises. These things lead to deaths.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's a bit like Gangs of New York, the movie, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, how many people were killed, do we know, in the Battle of the Diamond?
I think I read 30.
So it really is something like Daniel Day-Lewis and Liam Neeson having it out in the
square. Yeah. As in that period around time of the founding of the Orange Order, that we see a lot of the migration from South Ulster over to Connacht from the Catholic population. And it's really to Hell or to Connacht, which we always associate, I think, growing up with the Cromwellian period.
Yeah.
But it is, to a large extent, that period there.
That's right.
And at the time, I think Armagh was the most populous county in Ireland, as with the linen industry exploding and, you know, the first steps in industrialisation. There's also a pressure on land. Linen weaving is still cottage industry, a home industry.
Yeah, I mean, one way of looking at it is actually, like, County Armagh is a tinderbox because it's overpopulated. There's competition between these rival groups for the resources that are there. You know, so again, and that kind of sets a precedent for kind of sectarian conflict to the present day, I suppose.
And when we get back to, you know, the different confessional strands within Irish Protestantism, as you mentioned there with the United Irishmen, attracting a lot of support from Presbyterians. Presbyterians are quite open to a lot of things to do with land reform because they would have been tenant farmers in rural Ulster. They wouldn't really have had that much in common with the Church of Ireland ascendancy landlord class, who do really see a benefit to building up a society such as the Orange Order.
Yeah, I mean, one obstacle to us seeing that period, and we're still talking about the 1790s clearly, is that we see it through the prism of, you know, our own day and the century that's gone, the 20th century. So, but areas today that would be very strongly loyalist or unionist were also strongholds of the United Irishmen, you know, because, and they were Presbyterian areas. So, you know, North Antrim, County Down and North Down, these were the strongholds of the United Irishmen, you know, partly, very largely because Presbyterians weren't full citizens. A lot of Presbyterians were doing well in business at the time as well. So you've got this classic thing of like a group which is economically starting to do quite well, but doesn't have any political power, which is, like, you know, a classic pretext for a revolution, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, in the 1790s, there were apparently some Presbyterian Irishmen, but Presbyterians at that particular time were far more likely to join the United Irishmen, certainly in Ulster. Although quite quickly, I think, after the uprising of 1798, that began to change, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And particularly events such as those in Wexford would have soured a lot of Northern Protestants towards the United Irishmen.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so today, again, we view 1798 through the commemorations and so on, where United Irishmen were almost celebrated as, I don't know, peacekeepers or something like that. But like, if you look at the nitty gritty of the 1798 rebellion, it was very dirty war, as all civil wars or rebellions are. And I mean, in some places it was quite sectarian. Now, the historians of the period have generally tended to argue that it was the government side and the yeomanry and so on which was the worst offender here, but there was Catholic sectarianism, there were massacres certainly of loyalists, and certainly also these were publicised in the aftermath of the rebellion,
mm-hmm.
for the precise reason of extracting Presbyterians and other Protestants from the United Irishmen.
I think as well, anyone who lives in Dublin who's walked up Dawson Street is probably unaware of the brass plaque on the ground at the bottom of Dawson Street near Trinity College, where the Grand Orange Lodge of Ireland was founded to encompass the whole country.
That's right. And I mean, you know, whereas Dublin had recently enough become a Catholic majority city, that was very recent at the time. And certainly Dublin loyalism was a strong force for certainly the first half of the 19th century. It started to wane a bit after that. So moving on a little bit, I mean, in the 19th century, the Orange Order has a strained relationship with the new British state in Ireland. It's actually banned twice in the first half of the 19th century.
Well, funny enough, wasn't the Orange Order in many ways quite opposed to the Act of Union?
Yeah, I mean,
not universally, but there was definitely a current.
I mean, I gather that there's mixed opinions about that, because some people say, well, it's a bulwark against insurrection, but other people say, well, we had our Protestant Kingdom of Ireland and we're giving it up. So I think there's mixed opinions on that. But certainly when we get to things like Catholic emancipation in the late 1820s, the Orange Order is very much opposed by it, and it's actually banned around that time, mm-hmm. for fear of disorder in the late 1820s. And then we again come to Daniel O'Connell's campaign for repeal of the Union, which is basically for a reversal of the Act of Union, but with Catholics excluded now. Mm-hmm. So it would have meant Catholic-run kingdom, basically. The Orange Order is again banned. So, but I find that interesting because, you know, the fact is that there was a liberal government certainly in place by the 1830s. Thomas Drummond, who was, I think, the chief secretary for Ireland at the time, you know, made a lot of liberal reforms. For example, he reformed all the corporations so that it was not quite one man, one vote, but something like that. And he also banned the Orange Order. So, you know, whereas I suppose the Republican narrative of Irish history would, or nationalists would say that, you know, the British state was always on the side of the Orange Order. That's certainly not true. The Orange Order is viewed with a great deal of suspicion by British governments in the first decades of the Union.
As well, it can't have been easy to govern a country that's prone to religious-based faction fights throughout the countryside.
Exactly, and I think the British politicians, my impression is, viewed the Orange Order in that way most of the time, that it was this plebeian society of roughnecks who, you know, caused disorder.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the issues that the Orange Order were raising were more directed to issues facing the Church of Ireland rather than Protestantism as a whole. So they were deeply opposed to things like the disestablishment of the Church of Ireland.
Yeah, completely. And I mean, one thing that I did a few years ago was I looked into a group called the Dublin Protestant Operative Association. And, you know, it's a loyalist group. It's what they've called themselves, an ultra-Protestant group. They're opposed to all these things. They're opposed to things like Grant allowing the Catholic Church to open churches. And they're certainly opposed to Catholic emancipation. And they're opposed to repeal of the Union and so on and so on. But almost all of them are Orange Order members as well. And they quite clearly say in their meetings were members of the Fraternal Order. Two fraternal orders, often there were Masons as well. The narrative at that time is very much that this is, you know, it's something of the established church. They don't want to see this establishment of it. They don't want to see other religions basically tolerated. Now, speaking of that particular group, which is led by this firebrand preacher called Tresham Greggs, one thing I found interesting was it was a Dublin-based group, a basically Southern-based group, which was much more viable than we probably would think today. But he did try to go to Belfast, because Belfast is a Protestant city. And he actually was chased away by stone-throwing Presbyterians. Now, at this date, I mean, Presbyterians are no longer United Irishmen, for the most part, or anything like that. They are supporters, generally, of the Union. But I find it interesting. They didn't like Tresham Greggs. They viewed him as a, you know, an ultra-Protestant and Anglican Church of Ireland, someone who was not on their side. Mm-hmm. So I do find that interesting.
Yes, I think we aren't aware, particularly people who are outside the Protestant tradition, of the different currents within Protestantism in Ireland, and maybe the different tensions as well that do exist and have existed in the past. The importance and the rise of fraternities in Ireland, that different groups, different religious groups would band together and establish these fraternities, and the benefits it would have to being a member of one of these groups.
Very much so. And the Ribbon Men, and to a degree, became the Ancient Order of Hibernians, which is almost a direct Catholic parallel of the Orange Order.
Well, you can see as well, like, if we get into really, you know, the nuts and bolts of the Orange Order, they very much correspond to each other. Like, people from outside Ireland who may see, like, you know, once a year on their television screens, men in suits and bowler hats and white gloves and orange sashes or collarettes that they wear around their neck. With the Ancient Order of Hibernians, those are green sashes. And another group that has almost entirely disappeared in Ireland, the Foresters, would have green sashes as well.
Yeah, and that's another Catholic society.
Well, that's a funny one.
Or National Society might be better. They're not. Whereas the Ancient Order of Hibernians is very,
very much so.
It is Catholic. It's exclusively Catholic. In the same way, the Orange Order is exclusively Protestant.
Yes, and I think if you read a lot of the accounts of the Ancient Order of Hibernians and their role in the Irish Parliamentary Party and in Ireland generally in the 1890s and the first two decades of the 20th century, they're not adverse to using political violence.
Certainly not. So they're really, you could almost say, two sides of the same coin at that particular time. Before we leave the 19th century, something that you mentioned to me earlier, Cahill, was this violence that happened sometimes with great deadliness in Ireland in the 19th century also spread to America. There was a riot between Irish nationalists or Catholics in New York and Orangemen in the 19th century.
Yeah, well, that's in the 1870s. 1870, and then there's a repeat in 1871. The 1871, 12th of July, is far more deadly, with a lot more people killed. And it is interesting, in that period, you're seeing a huge increase in the Irish population in the United States, and particularly in New York City. Like, New York City has a huge Irish population.
And let's be fair, I mean, we probably take too much of an ethnocentric, almost a sectarian view of this, but they're both Catholics and Protestants going to America.
Yes, like, I think that's the thing, that we, when we talk about that type of migration to America in the mid to late 19th century, when we say Irish, it's almost shorthand for Catholic, whereas that's not the case at all. And when we look at Irish America now, we tend to think of, you know, Irish America being Irish Catholic America, but that's not the case. In the 18th century, the large majority of Irish people going over to the US are Irish Protestants, particularly Irish Presbyterians, But they're going down to the southern states around Virginia.
Yeah. Appalachia, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Tennessee, Kentucky, the Carolinas.
But it's interesting that there's an Orange Order in New York, which seems it seems very odd in this at this remove, but there was. There really was.
Yeah, and it's also, as well, it feeds into the whole question of assimilation.
Mm.
That whereas Irish Catholics or people from a Catholic background would still cling more so to the hyphenated American as Irish America, the Irish Protestants have more easily blended into a general white American culture and less likely to describe themselves by their ethnic background.
Absolutely. Although, I mean, one theory I've heard is that the term hillbilly actually comes from William of Orange. So there does appear to have been an Irish tradition in places like Appalachia, you know, rural.
Oh, near, absolutely. Yeah,
mid-America.
And in places like New York, you have not just New York, but other large centres we associated with Irish America, like Boston, Philadelphia, places like this. We have the growth of nativism and the Know Nothing Party, which would have been deeply anti-Catholic and anti-immigrant. And Irish Protestants would have been more readily able to assimilate into American society. And there is that conflict over jobs, over economic status, and over political power in these...
which really, you know, it's a mirror of what's happened in Ireland for the previous 100 years. Yeah. When we think of Orangeism today, we probably are going to think of some of, you know, the monolith that existed in the 20th century, where you have in the north of Ireland the Unionist Party and the Orange Order.
Mm.
And I would say that the origins of that are in the Home Rule crises of the late 19th century. Would you go along with that?
Yes, because I think in the when we see the founding of Northern Ireland, and to be fair, a lot of this is in response to like James Craig's pronouncements about I'm an Orangeman first and this is a Protestant state for Protestant people. At the same time in the South you have politicians making quite, you know, sectarian comments and talking about like the Free State as being a Catholic country and Catholic social teaching being instituted into the legislation and the constitution.
But yeah, for sure, but it's a two-way street. But even going back before that, I mean, if you go back to the days of the Home Rule crisis, so we talked about the mid-19th century, and it's really, there are some Presbyterians, but it's really an Anglican thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the Church of Ireland is disestablished in 1869. I would say certainly that it's in the Home Rule crisis where Ulster Protestants are, you know, almost unanimously against Home Rule, that Presbyterians and Church of Ireland begin to come together, and you can almost say a new Irish tradition, the Unionist tradition, which is founded at that time, I would say.
Yes, and like when you look at a body like the Orange Order, when Unionists are facing, particularly in Ulster, but not just in Ulster, just interesting stuff about Orangeism in Dublin as well, playing the same role, but as a network that can spread out throughout the province and throughout the country, that can harness that feeling towards things like the Ulster Covenant, true lodges, getting people involved, and the founding of things like the Ulster Volunteers as well.
Yeah, and I mean, without wishing to only play up the negative side, I mean, the Orange Order is very intimate, and its parades on the 12th of July are very intimately associated with violence in things like the 1882 riots in Belfast, where there's about 50 people killed over the weekend of the 12th, and also with the foundation of the Ulster Volunteers, the original UVF.
Well, I think that's the thing when, thankfully, nowhere near to the same extent. And at the same time, people who are members of the Orange Order will make the point that the vast, vast majority of marches pass off without any problems whatsoever. But I think for our generation, when we were growing up, the phrase marching season was synonymous with increased tension, with violence at sectarian interfaces, and things. So it was an area where the police would be stretched, where it was a cause for a deep concern.
Absolutely.
And would pass off peacefully.
Absolutely. And while, you know, while not wishing to stress the negative thing, the reality is, I mean, the 12th has, certainly in Belfast, in that particular part of Ulster, the 12th has always been an occasion for violence, and sometimes quite severe violence. Yeah. But One thing we wanted to talk about was the Orange Order itself is not a monolith, because there was an interesting split in the Orange Order in the early 20th century, the Independent Orange Order.
Yes. You can see with the type of people who were involved, like the Lindsay Crawford and Tom Sloan, that for such an important body within Irish Unionism and Irish Protestantism, that many members would have seen it probably as monolithical, as not accommodating dissent in some ways. So people like that were willing to break off and form their own independent Orange Order.
Yeah, and the story is actually really interesting, and I think it still has parallels today. So what's interesting about the Independent Orange Order is they actually start as a more hardline unionist split, you know, from the Orange Order. I mean, they're unhappy with campaigning for the Unionist Party is the ostensible reason, I think. But they're very hardcore on, you know, anti-Catholic, anti-Home Rule and so on. But what's interesting is they evolve in another direction. So they're alienated from, they're basically a working class Belfast split. But within a few years, what the Orange Order, the Independent, sorry, Orange Order is saying is we're in favour of trade unionism, which is a nascent force. Alex Boyd, who was a councillor, supported James Larkin in his famous 1907 Belfast dock strike. James Larkin organised, you know, the NUDL, the Union of Dock Labourers, and he led parades through the Shankill, the Protestant district, and through the Falls, the Catholic district. He appeared, there's a legend that he marched on the 12th with Alex Boyd. That's not true, actually. Larkin is, after all, a Catholic and also a socialist. But the Independent Orange Order starts to speak in favour of trade unionism, and they even start to speak about not home rule, but something less than that. They start to speak in favour of, you know, this idea of, like, federation, something like devolution within the United Kingdom. So for a few years there, the Independent Orange Order is actually a kind of a left-wing working class alternative to the Orange Order. Now that doesn't last, as it happens. So Lindsay Crawford, who's a journalist, he's a kind of a publicist for them, possibly the driver of the left-wing stuff, he gets driven out, and eventually serves in the Free State in some capacity.
Yeah,
and the Independent Orange Order eventually returns to a much more hardline loyalist position. But there's a few years there of something different.
Because we tend to think of unionist history and that sort of, like, first 50 years of Northern Ireland as very monolithical. You have the Orange Order, the Unionist Party, a one-party government, and not very much room for dissent or moving outside.
And that is, to a degree, true. And also you can lump in the Masons, who I believe were very important in the police force, the RUC.
Well, that's another interesting point we should touch on. We talked about, like, on the nationalist side, and you have groups like the Ancient Order of Hibernians and the Irish National Foresters. But the Orange Order wouldn't be the only loyal order.
That's right.
You have the Royal Black Preceptory, and they are made up of Orange men, but it's a separate, you have to be an Orange man to be a member. But that is, and they wear black sashes. They are very, very much more Freemason-ish. They have a series of degrees. You move up through degrees like the Freemasons. And they're most associated with the sham fight at Scarva in County Down, which would be...
Which is not kind of a reenactment of the William White War.
But not a historically accurate reenactment, no. As in King James and King Billy fight each other, have a sword fight.
That's right. I presume King Billy wins, eh?
I presume, yes. And then the other main loyal order would be the Apprentice Boys of Derry. And obviously relating to the siege of Derry.
Yeah.
And the Apprentice Boys.
Although, like the Orange Order, I don't think dating back to that period. I mean, I think it's a later creation. Based on the legend of the Siege of Derry, where the Protestant city resisted.
Yes.
The Jacobite hordes.
As you say, like the membership levels of the Orange Order now wouldn't be anywhere near as large as they were in the 60s.
Yeah.
But for the big annual events, like the 11th of July, the 11th night bonfires, and then the 12th of July, the processions, they would get a huge response of people going and watching the marches, lining the routes, and then going to the church ceremonies and also going to the fields afterwards to
absolutely
listen to the speakers and watch the bands. And
I mean, you know, to be very honest, for a southerner of nationalist background, it's very difficult to view the Orange Order parades with equanimity. But, I mean, I'm told by Ulster Protestant friends of mine that it was perceived in their youth as just a day out. You know, it was kind of the national day of Northern Ireland in a way that it couldn't be today in the era of power sharing.
Well, the national day for Protestants in Northern Ireland.
Yeah, but I mean, I think, the mentality was that there's even a loyalist phrase, "We are the people." I mean, the mentality was that, you know, the Catholics were an unwanted extra, I think. But moving on to that, I mean, at the tail end of the 12th and so on was always a tense time, I think, has always been a tense time ever since the early 1800s. But at the tail end of the Troubles, the parades of the Orange Order and the other loyal orders suddenly became extremely contentious, and we had a couple of very tense standoffs.
Yeah, definitely.
Funny enough, during the peace process rather than during the Troubles.
Yes, we have that sort of 4-year period between the signing of the Good Friday Agreement in 1998 and the first IRA ceasefire in 1994. And the complaint by a lot of the unionist parties and unionists in general was that the Republicans were taking the war onto a different front by opposing traditional unionist marches where the demographics may have changed.
Yeah, now let's be concrete about this. So there's one issue in Portadown, and there was already trouble and riots over this in the 80s when the Orange Order wanted to march through the tunnel, which is actually the traditional Catholic area of Portadown. Now, I believe what happened there was there's been rebuilding and road changes, and the tunnel was closed off to all traffic, I think. And now the main thoroughfare through the main Catholic area was the Carvalho Road, but it also coincided, I think, with the traditional route of the Orange Order from the Church of Ireland Church at Drumcree back into Portadown. So that's one.
Well, that's true, and you can see as well with, although the spark that lights it off, these confrontations being about traditional marching routes and stuff, it does seem to be heightened at times of political instability, like the Anglo-Irish Agreement in the mid-80s, as you were saying there, and the period before the Good Friday Agreement.
But I think you can look at this all the way back. I mean, you know, without using history as a, you know, determiner, I mean, you know, back in 1882, like I said, the Home Rule Bill plus the 12th of July is a lethal combination. I mean, there's dozens of people killed in Belfast, including a lot of police officers. You know, moving on, I mean, the 1920, there's very deadly riots in Belfast, and there's Catholics expelled from the shipyards and all, and there, it does happen around the 12th and so on. Belfast's Bloody Sunday in 1921, where over 3 days, I think about 30 or 40 people were killed, resembled more a battle than a riot, that one, because there's a lot of firearms used. You know, it happens on the 11th of, or the 10th of July, but it continues over the weekend of the 12th. So, you know, this has happened all the way through. It's not just in that period, but...
The most famous case as well being although it's not the Orange Order, it's the Apprentice Boys, is the day people tend to think of as the day the trouble started was the Apprentice Boys March.
The Battle of the Bogside, exactly. Yeah. I mean, but look, going again, like jumping again to the 90s, this is a time of political tension. You know, things are up in the air with the peace process, and it does seem to have heightened the confrontations over these parades.
We've seen now in recent years that where there has been dialogue between residents and the loyal orders, that things have passed off relatively peacefully, and these marches have become non-contentious.
But we both remember these very well, you know, the Drumcree standoff, and also, and we should say also in Ardoyne in North Belfast, and also the around the walls of Derry.
Yeah.
So let's take people back for it, people who don't remember.
Well, I think the Drumcree event, that was 3 years in a row, was it, or four years in a row?
Where there was basically sieges of the...
Yeah, like 1 year they were prevented, the Orange Order was prevented from marching down the Carvalho Road, and this was greeted by loyalists from all over Northern Ireland marching up to the police lines near the Drumcree Church, and you have loyalist paramilitaries like Johnny Adair and people like that. And it was very intimidating.
Billy Wright.
And in this period as well, you see the LVF being founded and Catholic taxi driver being killed.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of violence over Drumcree, and there's a lot of rioting. I mean, it's almost a repeat of the Ulster Workers' Council strike in terms of its disruption. I mean, there's roads blocked, and you know. And also, I mean, there's a house petrol bombed about.
Yeah.
Not in Drumcree, but regarding the Drumcree dispute where two small children were killed.
Three small
children, you know, as well as, like you said, the LVF, which is Billy Wright's breakaway loyalist group, you know, assassinated a number of Catholics. So it's really serious violence. And also, whenever the march was let through, so it was let through, I think, in 96 and 97, if I remember right.
Yes, and I think people would remember two real things through. What people would remember, first one was the violence on Garvahy Road itself when the residents were moved off the road by the police.
Yeah.
And the second would be the local MP, David Trimble, and Ian Paisley, after marching through the Garvahy Road, they arrived back in the centre of Portadown and they're holding hands triumphantly. And
yeah, the optics, as they say now, are not good.
No.
But I mean, at the time, the Orange Orders procession down Garvahy Road was greeted with the most ferocious rioting in nationalist areas of Belfast and Derry and elsewhere in the following days. So while I mean, it's not that lethal, I mean, firearms aren't used that much. I mean, it was pretty bad. It was certainly a threat to the peace process at the time.
And that's interesting, like in recent years, there's been a desire from some quarters within the Orange Order to see 12th of July like a St. Patrick's Day event where everybody in the community could go out and watch the parades and listen to the bands and stuff, but it seems still quite a long way off before we'd ever get to that point.
Well, it seems to me, as an outsider and not having, in fairness, ever attended the 12th of July or the 11th night, the bonfire night, it seems to me that Orangeism is to a degree going back to its roots as like a plebeian organisation, an unruly kind of working class organisation. There seems to be a lot of drinking, to be honest, a lot of what we might call antisocial behaviour, which wouldn't have been tolerated in the traditional Orange Order, I suspect. There was always involvement of paramilitaries during the Troubles, but they seem to have quite a strong hold on events these days, so it seems to me. So it does seem to me that the middle-class unionists are actually shunning the modern 12 to a greater degree.
Well, when you think back about what benefit would it have to somebody to actually join the Orange Order and be a member of it, at a certain stage it would be beneficial in a state and a community where there was a lot of work to be had. There was a lot of big industries in Belfast, and it could almost guarantee you employment.
And in politics as well.
Particularly those early decades of the Northern Ireland state, where the vast majority of cabinet members, even ordinary MPs within the Unionist Party, are members of the Orange Order. Does the Orange Order have that type of benefit nowadays to your average Protestant?
Probably not. Probably not, indeed. And especially in the days when political power is shared in Northern Ireland.
And from the Orange Order's point of view, they can always point to the fact that during the Troubles, I think there's about 300 members of the order were killed, and they had to.
But mostly, without in any way wanting to justify violence, but mostly killed while serving in the UDR and the RC and so on.
Yes, not exclusively, but yes.
And to be fair, I mean, there were occasions where Orange Halls were attacked and they were machine gunned. I think Tully Fallon Orange Hall, is that right, by the INI?
Yeah.
So let's not gloss over that.
Well, we see it in recent years as well. There have been sectarian attacks against Orange Halls, particularly ones in more isolated border areas, are more subject to attack. But it's strange, well, if you go not just in the north, but you go around the country, there are buildings now that I suppose people would be quite surprised to learn that they were once an Orange Hall.
I think we can finish up by talking about the remnants of the Southern Orange tradition. So we mentioned that the Orange Order was actually very strong in areas like South Leinster and so on at its foundation, and in Dublin throughout much of its history, had a strong presence in Dublin. I mean, even as late as the Irish Civil War, one of the flashpoints was the Orange Order Hall in Fowler's Hall in Parnell Square, which was taken over by the anti-treatyites and was a scene of fighting. But today, what remains of the Southern Irish tradition?
Yes, the I think people would be surprised to find out how many lodges there were in Dublin at that time, pre-partition, and also the strength of the Orange opposition within Dublin to Home Rule and then later independence, the crowds that they would have got, the organisational ability of the Orange Order to marshal opposition to Home Rule and later independence in this period during the Home Rule crisis. And you would have had huge meetings organised in places like the Rotunda for Orange men and Orange women in Dublin, addressed by people like Edward Carson.
Well, wait, there aren't Orange women, are there?
Yes, there is.
Really?
Okay, yes, sorry. There is not.
Excuse me.
Well, women are not members of the Orange Order. There is affiliated Orange Lodges for women.
Okay.
And so you have people like Bonner Law coming over to Dublin, who would have been the Conservative leader at the time and deeply opposed to Home Rule. And then, as well, at the time when you have the Ulster Volunteers set up, you also have the Loyal Dublin Volunteers.
That's right. There was an armed Loyalist paramilitary group in Dublin with a considerable cache of arms.
Yeah.
Now, they were never used. They were discovered, I think, late in the 20s or 30s.
30s, yes. By OPW workers who were moving furniture and a wall came away. I think it was 900 rifles. And about 2,000 rounds of ammunition.
Right. And also, you told me an interesting story before we started recording of Orangemen during the Rising of 1916 in Dublin.
Yes, I came across a talk online a fellow was given to the Dublin and Wicklow Lodge of the Orange Order during the centenary of 1916. He was talking about one of the leaders of the Apprentice Boys and an Orange man who were in Dublin during the Easter Rising, and they were stuck in Fowler Hall. But when they eventually managed to leave the building after a couple of days, they were arrested by the military, sent to Kilmainham for 9 days, and then put on the boat with all the other arrested insurgents and sent over to Wales, where the insurgents were interned in Frongoch, which they must have been furiously proclaiming their innocence for several weeks before they were released.
And they must have had a very interesting relationship with the volunteers and citizen army fighters who were interned in Frongoch. So I think we can say, though, that today, I mean, you'd have to look quite hard for the Irish tradition in the South. I mean, I suspect people have sashes and attics and so on, but certainly there's not much of a visible presence in the South anymore.
No, and is there that association between Protestantism and Orangeism? Or unionism, for that want of a better word, in the 26 counties.
Yeah, it's not really. I would say not in my experience anyway. I mean, there's kind of a vestigial thing. They know that their ancestors were probably unionists in some cases, Orange men, but generally speaking, Southern Protestants have for the most part given up on that.
Yeah, when we think about Orangeism and being a Protestant fraternity, it's not just about Protestantism. There's also the loyalist aspect as well, the union and the commitment to a Protestant crown. Like, that loyalty is dependent on and conditional on the monarch remaining Protestant.
But again, that goes right back to the foundation of the Orange Order. I mean, and the likes of Tresham Gregg, who I mentioned before, said something like, you know, if the British Empire be not Protestant, you know, we have no interest in it. Mm-hmm. You know, our interest is in truth, I said, and you know, reading between the lines, you know, and us governing Ireland and Ireland being governed in our interest. In the north of Ireland, I suppose we should conclude by saying what do we think is the future of Orangeism in the north of Ireland?
Well, it's hard to say, obviously, because we're both outside that tradition. And not only that, we're not Northerners either. So we have very little contact on a day-to-day basis or any basis at all with Orangeism. So it seems to be in decline, but who can say in 20 or 30 years time where it will be? If you look at Hibernianism now, is very much
is moribund, but Hibernianism kind of gets replaced by Republicanism in the early 20th century, so I wouldn't say, you know, it's a direct parallel. I mean, I would say perhaps in a pessimistic conclusion, the history of Orangeism shows that it waxes and wanes. It can be an outlawed society, which is scorned, but it can be very useful at times of tension for mobilising people.
Yeah.
And we might see that again in the future.
But does it always have to be a negative? Could it be a positive, playing devil's advocate?
Well, let us hope so.
And I think as well, we can't let the episode pass without the greatest contradiction or more most inconvenient fact about the Orange Order, which is very much associated with anti-popery. What did the Pope in 1691, what did he make of the William White War?
Oh, okay, well, this is actually, you know, this was a trope certainly a few years ago. So the actual William White War, the real one as opposed to the fictionalized one, was part of a European war, which was basically France against the rest of Europe, including Catholic Europe, including Spain, and including the papacy. So the Pope at the time was very unhappy with the expansion of Louis XIV outside the borders of France in towards what's now Belgium and the Netherlands. And the Pope supported William of Orange and supported his coalition against Louis XIV and his client, James II. At the actual Battle of the Boyne, yes, it's quite true, the Pope was on the other side. It is not true, however, what is sometimes repeated, that the Pope had a Te Deum, thanks be to God, said for William's victory. He didn't go quite that far, because he was, after all, a heretic. It is quite true that the Pope was on the Orange side at the Battle of the Boyne.
Well, if the myth is more interesting than the fact, print the myth. It's like King Billy's white horse. Was he riding a white horse? Probably not. But there you go. Well, there you go. If there's anyone who wants to contact us, you can get in touch on the website, irishhistoryshow.ie. You can contact us on Twitter or Facebook. We have our Facebook page as well. And thanks very much for listening. My name is Carl Brennan, and John Dorney has been here too. See you again soon.